Stu Does America.
We've got a great show for you today. Lots of stuff to get to, but I want to start by doing the COVID origin cover-up. This is a story that's been bubbling under the surface a little bit. And I guess, like, if you were doing something wrong and you knew there was a big investigation that might happen in the future, you kind of know your lines, right? Like, I've never, thankfully, been on that side of things. But I imagine if I'm being FOIA'd and I'm in the government, I'm going to, like, do everything I can to keep things on different apps, maybe private emails, everything else. Because I don't want that stuff to come out. I don't want that stuff to be on the cover of the New York Times or some other actually responsible journalistic organization. That's kind of what we're seeing here. And it's really fascinating how it's falling apart. COVID origin accountability. A blistering congressional hearing forces accountability on COVID origins. This is from Zeynep Tufekci. She's an opinion columnist over at the New York Times. And she actually has been one of the few that has covered a lot of this stuff pretty darn well. That's been pretty rare, as we know, in mainstream media. We are now seeing some fallout from this, but not as much as I would like. For example, Biden administration has suspended funding for the scientists at the center of the COVID lab leak theory. This is Peter Daszak. Of course, you remember this name as we went through, years ago now, all this stuff with the EcoHealth Alliance, what funding went over there when we're talking about gain of function research. We've talked about this, the Rand Paul hearings and everything else. And there's a new story out today. The Fauci cover-up is falling apart. This is from the Washington Examiner. All this leading and basically coming from a bunch of emails. And I want to go through these emails with you because you may have seen excerpts of some of them. You may have seen bits and pieces, but people aren't really focusing on them all that much. Most of these come from a guy, Dr. David Morenz. He's a senior advisor at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. And it's one thing for them to talk about the lab leak theory and say, well, I don't know, maybe it's true. I don't know if we should say that or not. But that sort of back and forth we have seen in a lot of stuff. This is much more blatant. This is, we are trying to hide things from the American people. Straight out, they got caught saying these things. Let me give you the examples. Just go through them, and we'll talk about them as we go. Here's one. This is Peter and colleagues talking to Peter Daszak, among others. As you know, I always try to communicate on Gmail because my NIH email is FOIA'd constantly. Again, his business email is FOIA'd, it would be released, so he's going to Gmail to avoid it. He's talking about this outwardly. Yesterday, my Gmail was hacked, probably by these GOF a-holes, meaning gain-of-function a-holes, and until IT can get it fixed, I have to occasionally email from my NIH account. I spent a couple hours today, but couldn't fix it. Stuff sent to my Gmail gets sent to my phone. Don't worry, just send to any of my addresses, and I will delete anything I don't want to see in the New York Times. I mean, these guys were aware what they were talking about. They did not want out there. They did not want you to see it. And remember, what they're talking about here is your life, your health, your medical choices, all things that at the time we were talking about from more of a, rights-based perspective. You should be able to make these choices, whether the information is good or not. And yet they were on the other side of this trying to hide this information from you. They did not want you to know what they were talking about. Let me give you more. On 18th April 2020, Peter Daszak emailed me and Tony, congratulating Tony on standing up for science. That email somehow fell in the hands of a congressman, probably via a FOIA of someone who didn't delete it, as I did. I delete all of Peter's emails and others relating to origin when the crap started hitting the fan. He says, anyway, the congressman got a copy of Peter D's email from someone at NIH, and now he wants to get to any reply Tony and I had with anything but getting back to Peter. Mine was erased long ago. I verified that today, and I feel pretty sure Tony's was too. That's Tony Fauci talking about erasing emails. The best way to avoid FOIA hassles, again, that's a Freedom of Information Act, is to delete all emails when you learn a subject is getting sensitive. Again, FOIA is not something you avoid hassle on. It's the law. It's like the best way to avoid getting hassled by the police after a murder is to make sure you cut up the body and send it all over the world so it can they can't tie it to you. I don't know. Like, no, you're supposed to actually just like pay attention to the law. That's one way to go. Another way to go is not to murder. More emails from this doctor. You are right. I need to be more careful. However, as I mentioned before, I learned from our FOIA, Freedom of Information Act lady here, how to make emails disappear after I am FOIA'd.
but before the search starts. So I think we are all safe. Plus, I deleted most of those earlier emails after sending them to Gmail. Well, first of all, he was not safe. Obviously, we now see in the emails he was wrong. But there was a FOIA lady who was advising him how to delete his emails so they would not be caught in a search. These are massive crimes. This is not just some little scandal. Not only does this doctor and all the other doctors that were deleting emails in massive trouble for this, or should be, but also the FOIA lady that was advising them to delete them. That is a massive problem and a crime. These are offenses that lead to prison time. And they are all out here. How do you not know about this? If you haven't heard about these emails, can you believe it? How do you not know about them? They're not fakes. They are real emails that really happened. Here's another one. Basically, again, the same doctor, David Morenz. Basically, my Gmail is now safe from FOIA and hacking on all devices, including government computer and phone, as my private computer and iPad. This should make it safe to communicate safely with you, Peter, and others, as long as we use my private Gmail. They are avoiding you. Not to mention the law. They're going around the law, that's for certain. But they want you to not be aware about their actual opinions about one of the most important issues of our time, right? This is, you know, their estimates say that, what, 11 figures died because of what happened in Wuhan? And they're, you know, basically denying the possible lab leak origin and deleting the evidence that they were considering it. Is this a problem for you? Let me give you more. You may be amused at the following aside. That was a big surprise to me. He was asking my opinion about what's going wrong with the CDC, and the process said, out of the blue, it was he that got Rochelle Walensky her job as CDC director by lobbying for her to Ron Klain. Well, she does wear a skirt. I poured a little cold water on her, but she was undeterred in her thinking that she's the cat's pajamas. Again, Ron Klain being involved in this is also information that's pretty darn interesting. Again, David Morenz talking to Peter Daszak, again, one of the central guys. When you talk about gain-of-function research, he's been the guy in the middle of this. P.S., I forgot to say, there's no worry about FOIAs, which is amazing in an email that has been FOIA'd. He says, I can either send stuff to Tony on his private Gmail or hand it to him at work or at his house. He is too smart to let colleagues send him stuff that could cause trouble. Now, again, this guy's a moron, and he did this over and over again and got caught. But what he's saying here is he sent stuff to Tony. The stuff he sent to Tony Fauci, we have not seen most of that. Why? Certainly seems like the information pointing to the fact that Tony Fauci was deleting these emails before they could be FOIA'd. Now, we don't know that for a fact yet, but it certainly seems like where this is going. And in addition, he was actually handing him papers in person so that they could be avoided in FOIA searches. Again, they're avoiding you about your health. That's what was going on here. I'll give you another email. Again, this one from David Morenz to Peter Daszak and other names you will probably familiar with at the EcoHealth Alliance. The FOIAs are dreadful and paranoia-inducing. In the old days, we had to do them ourselves by hand. I mean, finding and printing out thousands of emails coming in and out. Now they sometimes FOIA text messages, too. Many FOIAs turn up thousands of pages of docs, and of course, most are meaningless. We are all smart enough to know to never have smoking guns. And if we did, we wouldn't put them in emails. And if we found them, we'd delete them. This is jaw-dropping stuff, because normally these things, these conversations obviously happen over beers, maybe in the back room somewhere. They don't happen on email. I mean, you never see them printed out like this, but this guy is in, should be in serious, serious trouble. I'll give you a couple more. I deleted the email. I now learned that every email I got or sent since 1998 is captured and will be turned over whether or not I instantly deleted it. Gmail, phone, text. I need scrupulously reply on those exclusively. Oops, says David Morenz, as he's caught. And of course, this one may be the one that made Rand Paul happiest. He goes through a whole thing about the origins of COVID, but he says this should go away if Rand Paul doesn't amplify it too much. So fingers crossed on that. Of course, Rand Paul sees the email, retweets it, and says, oops, is this amplifying it too much? I mean, the fact that Rand Paul is having fun with us, I appreciate, but he was they lied to his face over and over and over again. And all the time, they were worried about deleting the emails that put them in trouble. This is a massive scandal. This is much bigger than the Trump trial. This is much bigger than all the stories that we oh, gosh, did Harrison Butker say something we disagreed with? Oh, gosh, the kicker of the Kansas City Chiefs might not agree with all of our positions on mainstream media. This is going on. These emails are out there. They're real. And no one's talking about it. It is a crime. These are massive crimes have been uncovered in text, in emails. It's real. And no one is talking about it. Now, we will continue to talk about it. I don't know. Maybe people on the Blaze will be enough on this one. It's the evidence is so blatant. And there are people in Congress working hard to make sure you know the truth about this. But it's incredible that this is not getting more attention. Millions of people died here. This is a major story. It is the central part of what journalism should be doing right now, to find out how all of this happened. And yet here we are getting this completely ignored, where we're worried about, you know, whether a field goal kicker has the right political opinions. Priorities, everybody. Priorities. Back in a second. Since 2007, Folds of Honor has provided life-changing scholarships to the spouses and children of America's fallen or disabled in combat. We had Memorial Day just a few days ago. And, you know, gosh, it's amazing to think about all the sacrifice that these people have done for us. You know, so we can hide emails just like everyone else. They've done incredible work, these veterans. And now, you know, we've seen first responders be lumped into this as well with Folds of Honor, just helping out these veterans' families, these people killed in action. Well, Flying Ace has aligned with Folds of Honor now to ensure the children of our American heroes receive the education they deserve. As proud supporters of Folds of Honor, Flying Ace has had the privilege of providing hope to the families of those who protect our freedom. To that end, Flying Ace is proudly sponsoring four scholarships awarded quarterly this year. If you can, donate today. Help them make a great impact. Go to FlyingAceSpirits.com. FlyingAceSpirits.com. Scan the QR code on the screen if you want as well. That'll get you to the same place. The link is also in the show notes. When you purchase a bottle of Flying Ace, you'll also be donating to Folds of Honor. And you'll doing it in a fun way because you're getting Flying Ace. And you're going to enjoy that quite a bit. And then you can say, I just did it to donate to Folds of Honor. Whatever you want, whatever makes you feel better, you're going to get two really good things done at the same time. Make sure you use the promo code America when you do this and get free shipping on every order. It's FlyingAceSpirits.com, FlyingAceSpirits.com. The promo code is America.
Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Plötzlich fühle ich mich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Tiefenentspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
I'm joined now by Nathan Nipper. He's a writer and researcher for Glenn Beck right here on Blaze TV. And he also has a brand new book out. It's called American Inheritance. You can pick this up wherever you get your books. Make sure to order a copy today. Nathan, thanks very much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me, Stu. Good to see you.
Yeah, you had a big book out a couple of years ago now, around Christmas.
Yeah.
Went to, I know, number one on Amazon, and it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And now you got a new book out. You kind of had a Christmas one last time. This is, I mean, you're timing this well for like July 4th. Like, this is a good, it fits. Can you give me the outline, kind of the synopsis of the plot?
Sure. Yeah. American Inheritance is about Tom Brock. He's this young guy in his 20s, unemployed graduate student. He's considers himself a socialist, Bernie Sanders guy, you know, really buys into the whole left-wing view of America as irredeemably bad, racist, oppressive, the whole thing, you know. And he has this grandfather whom he's never met for reasons, obviously, that you find out in the story. And this grandfather is his political polar opposite. So the grandfather is very conservative. He's a Vietnam War veteran, wealthy entrepreneur, you know, believes in the American dream, thinks that the left is ruining this nation that he loves. And so when the grandfather becomes aware of Tom's, his grandson's radical politics, he offers him a deal that he can't really refuse. And that is that he can earn a sizable inheritance, money inheritance, if he will go on this cross-country road trip following an itinerary designed by the grandfather to try to alter his grandson's very cynical view of America. Mm. So Tom goes on this trip in his grandfather's old RV, and it's a 1979 Airstream Excella. And so the story's about his journey, you know, and the places and the people that he encounters that kind of challenge his perception of America's past, present, and future.
Yeah, it's interesting because this dynamic is so common today, right? Like where you have, it's no longer people are family members and they don't even know anything about their politics, right? Mm-hmm. Like it seems like now everyone knows everybody's politics, especially with social media and everything.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of families who really go through this. I mean, we have family members who are, you know, considerably on the left, way mm-hmm. farther left than we are.
Yeah.
And like, it's either just totally avoid it, avoid those conversations, or you dive in and it can get really messy.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I kind of miss the days when I think about when I was younger and I didn't know every celebrity, every person in my life. I didn't know their politics. You know, there were a lot of people that I knew growing up with that I'll think about them from time to time, and I'm like, I don't know how they voted, and that's fine, you know?
So, yes, it's more than fine.
Yeah, it's preferable in a lot of cases, right? And so, yeah, everything is so on the nose and wearing our politics on our sleeves that it just intrigued me, I guess, the idea of trying to build a story around what if these two characters had all these conversations that we say that we want to have, but do we really have them? I mean, you guys do, you know, you and Glenn on the radio show more than I think the average show. You'll have conversations with people that you disagree with. But by and large, we kind of stay in our bubbles, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea was intriguing to me to have them to be kind of stand-ins for the left and right. And they have a lot of conversations in this book that devolve into arguments for their side, trying to persuade each other, you know? And so hopefully it's an entertaining way to approach that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so common for so many people. You set this back in 2020.
Yeah.
It's an interesting time period. It's like, why did you pick 2020?
Why did I pick the worst year ever?
Yeah,
totally. Well, that first of all, I mean, that was kind of the main genesis of the story for me. It was started to come together in 2020. And it had a lot to do with the chaos of that year. You know, for me in my lifetime, 2020 was probably the closest to the sort of chaos that we had in 1968. I'm not that old. I wasn't alive in 1968, mm-hmm. but knowing what happened that year, I mean, you know, we had the pandemic, obviously, which was just chaos. And mm-hmm. then you had the BLM riots, Antifa riots. And oh, by the way, let's throw in a presidential election into all that.
How did we make it through that year?
I don't know. It was just, it really was so much chaos and so much uncertainty. And so as the idea for this book and these characters and how they would interact started to come together, I was like, it has to be set during then because there's just so much conflict weaving in and out of their story, you know? So.
And everything was so heightened. This show started like 3 or 4 weeks before everything shut down in the country in 2020.
That's right. Yeah.
So we got like 3 weeks or maybe even a week and a half of fun.
Right.
And then launched right into societal collapse.
Yeah.
But you saw that, like I had tons of people I know who had longstanding relationships that, you know, just completely dissolved over what the differences around not only just COVID, but George Floyd and everything else.
Sure.
I mean, it was, it makes sense to put it in this period because every difference was heightened. It was, mm-hmm. It was so aggressive in that period.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the best way to solve the problems, but it's certainly the best way to illustrate them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're totally right. It was, chaos for our lives. We wanted it to end, and it was so much like, when are we going to get to the end of this period? And then the presidential election and everything that happened. But ultimately, you know, I hoped that these characters would, well, one of the things that I hope that would come across in the book is this idea of informed patriotism. Like, I got tired of, for the past several years, of America's negative self-talk, right? And especially coming from the left, driven by the 1619 Project and these sorts of things. And it intrigued me the idea of what if someone who really believed the worst about America had to go through something like this, you know, to have conversations about things, points of view that he wasn't familiar with or that he didn't believe in, you know, and had to travel across the United States to various historical sites and sort of natural wonders. Would that change his perception of America. And, you know, I think that it can. I mean, it was inspired in part by a trip that I actually took with my family in 2020. We took a road trip out west to a few of these places. And it's just when you get out of your bubble and you see the vastness of America and sort of the awe of it, you know, that we don't focus on a lot because that's not cool, right? Everything's negative. But there's so much here and so much potential still. I think that if you get out and see some of that, it could change your perspective.
Yeah, we did a show last week on, you know, the Samuel Alito stuff where they're saying, well, you flew a flag. And it's like, well, some of these people have no idea of what the history of these things are, and why they're important. And someone like Samuel Alito, who's a historian, I mean, you know, of course, knows and cares about these things.
Yeah.
Knowing you too is like, you know, one of the things you do is you help craft arguments on a lot of times stuff that's related to history.
Yeah.
I have to think that a big part of this was you designing this itinerary. Like, you're looking for the best possible argument to win over a socialist.
I mean, yeah, you nailed it 100%.
Right.
I mean,
How did you design this, the itinerary? What would change the mind of a socialist?
Well, that part drove me crazy trying to narrow it down, right? I probably could have done 20 places. So some of them are places that I find personally inspiring. You know, I feel like you can't go to the Lincoln Memorial and really read the things on the walls, you know, without feeling something.
Yeah.
So a place like that, or Gettysburg, I'm giving some of them away, but, or even the Grand Canyon. I mean, it's just mesmerizing place, right? So there's that. There were some, like I said, from a family road trip I took a few years back that I had to include just because I enjoyed them so much. And ultimately, the way they all kind of tied together, because initially they seem sort of random and disjointed, is a secret that's sort of revealed at the end of the book.
Very interesting. Yeah. So what's the message here? Like, you're looking at this and you're saying, we've got a country where we have now seemingly more socialists than I ever thought we would.
Oh, my goodness,
You know, and with people who just don't appreciate this country anymore.
Right.
What are you trying to do with this book?
Yeah. So I mentioned the informed patriotism thing earlier. That comes from Ronald Reagan's farewell address to the nation. You know, I was watching that a few years ago, as you do, like on a Friday night.
Obviously.
With your family.
Cool.
And popcorn.
Kids do that. Yeah,
of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about, even back in 1989 when he gives this, he's already sensing this cultural move to, you know, for patriotism to be on the outs. It just is, you know, it's not a thing that the cool cats focus on, right? Mm-hmm. It's not popular to say that America has a lot going for it. And so his idea of informed patriotism was to develop patriotism, a love of your country. But the informed part, of course, is the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? It's got to be the real, actual truth. And so if you could put that in a entertaining novel form, I guess that's kind of what I was going for. But if it was just about history and politics, you know, that might be a bore. So it's woven throughout this overarching story of actually a very broken American family and this grandfather's sort of last-ditch effort to salvage it.
Well, it's almost like a patriotic Brewster's Millions. Do you remember the movie Brewster's?
right.
I loved that movie when I was a kid.
Yeah.
He was going to inherit $30 million or $300 million if he could spend $30 million in 30 days.
That's right.
It's a little different than that.
Yeah.
But it's on that premise, and I think it's a great way to kind of talk about these things,
right?
Especially when we are, I don't know, more divided than, I always want to say more divided than ever, but then I remember like the 1800s had some bad points.
Yeah, just a few.
Yeah, just a couple that were really, really divided. But it does feel like we can't talk to each other about this stuff. And, you know, it's sad that you have to bribe your grandson with, you know, millions of dollars to get him to listen to you. But I think that's 100% accurate.
Yeah.
The book is called American Inheritance, a novel by Nathan Nipper. It is available now. You can get it on Amazon and anywhere.
BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon. Yep.
Yeah. Go grab it. It's a great way to talk to not only your family, but just to enjoy, have a great read as we get into the July 4th season and beyond. Nathan, thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Stu. Appreciate it.
Kaffee in seiner besten Form. Mit Cubo wird jeder Kaffee auf Knopfdruck zum Genussmoment. Denn mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Chibo genießt du feinsten Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Vollmundige Aromen dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie und über 17 Sorten Kaffee für jeden Geschmack. Erlebe Premium-Kaffee schon ab 29 Euro. Entdecke jetzt die Qubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf tchibo.de.
Hunter Biden's baby mama will drop a tell-all book during the Democratic convention. This is going to be interesting. Going to be interesting. Now, you might remember she had a baby with Hunter Biden that basically the family did not acknowledge for a very long time. Eventually, after a lot of pressure, Joe Biden said, yeah, I have another grandkid or whatever. I don't think they've ever met. This is very recently talked about. Let me give you some of the highlights, though. This is going to cover the wild journey that would define London's young life and relationship with Hunter Biden. Out of the Shadows chronicles the roller coaster ride of the relationship, touching on a drug cook working at Rosemont Seneca's kitchen, strip clubs where Hunter might try the pole himself, protecting him from would-be terrorists in New York City, the night she grabbed two guns and was certain she would have to fatally shoot a crazed MMA fighter, and dozens of other stories that make the laptop debacle seem routine. This is gonna be fun. We need to get her on. We need to talk to her about this book when it comes out. So that is coming out during the convention, kind of timed for peak political importance. We will see how that one goes. Of course, that trial is coming up as well. Now, what is Biden hoping to do to push back on this? I'm hoping Taylor Swift will visit the White House tomorrow, along with the Kansas City Chiefs. The Chiefs are coming. Maybe Taylor will come too. That'll help. Good luck with that. And finally, before we leave, I want to give you this. And look, I understand the intent here is good, okay? The rules of Major League Baseball back in the day when, you know, no black players were allowed were completely insane. Everybody realizes this, skin color should not matter. Well, at least we used to realize that. Now the left all embraces that again. But my point still stands that skin color doesn't matter. Obviously, black players should have been able to play in the major leagues back in the day. The Negro Leagues, of course, came out of that environment. And there were some incredible players in the Negro Leagues. Some of the best players of all time played in the Negro Leagues. But what the Major League Baseball has decided to do now is to just count all of those games as if they were Major League games and count them towards the record, which to me, the intent is good, but it's bonkers. For example, now Josh Gibson has now become Major League Baseball's career leader with a .372 batting average, surpassing Ty Cobb's .367. He was a great player and may have been the greatest of all time if he had played. It was wrong that he couldn't play. But that doesn't mean you just embrace statistics from this league. This is a league in which they don't even have box scores for a quarter of the games played. They don't even know what happened. This was not an organized league in the way that Major League Baseball is. And there's been lots of leagues with great players. But you don't just count their stats. It doesn't make any sense. Gibson was now the career leader ahead of Babe Ruth as far as slugging percentage goes. Barry Bonds has been pushed down in slugging percentage. Barry Bonds, 2001, incredible year, is now pushed to fifth place behind a bunch of other players. The point here is not that, like, what happened back then was right. It was obviously wrong. But you don't just start creating, like, these records. You're ruining baseball's history by doing this in a way. Like, I just don't think it's the right way to do it. I'm going to Cooperstown, by the way, in a couple weeks to see the Baseball Hall of Fame. And one of the best parts is going to be going through the history of the Negro Leagues. Like, it's an incredible part of history. But just lumping it all in as if it was the same exact league, the same rules, the same situation, to me, just doesn't make any sense. Really happy to be joined by comedian Jeff Allen. He's the author of Are We There Yet? My Journey from Messed Up to a Meaningful Life, which is available now wherever you get your books. Make sure you go out and get it. I mean, Jeff is a really, really funny guy if you don't know Jeff. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Nice to be back.
Yeah.
So it's been how many years since I've been?
It's been a long time.
I'm glad you dropped the charges and finally, like, come back.
Well, you know, I mean, eventually those borders where you can go shrink and, right. you're fine. You are messed up life doesn't exactly capture it completely. Like, you had definitely had your moments where things were a little dark and you went down some tough roads. I mean, that's part of what's really interesting about your story is that, like, I think people get to the point where you were and feel like it's over. Like, they are screwed, right, and they can never turn it around. How did you
Well,
go
it doesn't
tell
help
people this
that
story?
When you get down to that point, everybody around you tells you can't.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's awful.
I just crawled into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, as beat up and broken as you would imagine you'd be, and they said, pray. I said, to what? And that was the journey. It was, okay, if God exists, then what does that look like?
Yeah.
Or is it true? And I went through, I never read a book in my entire life, and all of a sudden I became this vociferous reader. I mean, I just read everything I could get my hands on to try to find some point to anything. And you know, after 7 or 8 years, I met some guy on the road. He put the Bible in my hands of all the books. I tell people all the time, the bookstores are full of thousands of books of man's attempt to find meaning apart from God. Mm. And the Bible hasn't changed in 2,000 years. You know, it just sits there with dust all over it. And it was the book of Ecclesiastes. The first verse says, meaningless, meaningless, all in life is meaningless. And I said, yes, yes.
You're speaking directly to me.
I mean, it was. My wife was leaving me. I mean, it was just the perfect time to hear that. And to me, that was such a deep, profound truth. I was a nihilist at that point.
Yeah.
And when a nihilist hears it's all a waste of time, you go, yes, it is. And then later on in the chapter, Solomon talks about the eyes never get enough of seeing, the ears never get enough of hearing. In other words, you'll never see enough or hear enough to satisfy and sate whatever that is inside of us. So I'm looking at my video library, my audio library, and going, that's true. So I felt if that stuff was true, then other things in it must be true. Yep. And eventually I just got to Christ and the cross and thought, okay, I'm yours if it's true. Then it will last. If it's not, then it'll just be another one of many. I mean, I tried Buddhism. I wanted to raise the kids Buddhist. I came home one day, and I had a reason. Tammy goes, I said, I'm putting the kids in a Buddhist monastery. She says, over my dead body. And I went, oh, okay. That's how long it took her to talk me out of it. But I said, look, I'm a rage freak. My brother was a rage mm-hmm. freak. My dad was a rage freak. I got two boys. I don't want them to be like me.
Yeah.
And when's the last time you heard about a Buddhist road rage incident? You know, they're not exactly
out there,
you know, yeah. running their cars into stores, yeah. you know, because they're irritated. So anyway, I had
you don't
a
see a lot of Buddhist monks driving at all.
Not at
really.
All.
It's not just not
you don't
their
see
thing.
Them doing a whole lot.
So take people back to how you got to this low point, because you were part of like the stand-up comedy revolution. Like you were right in the middle of.
Yeah, I started at 78. So by 1980, there were more clubs than there were comedians. And yeah. I always said I got a chance to go out and be bad at something and make a few bucks.
Right.
Until I learned some craft. But yeah, I was living in Boston, which in the 80s. Outside of maybe San Francisco was the hottest place in the country
Huge.
To do comedy. Mm-hmm. And I was really blessed and fortunate. I mean, you could do 5 shows in one club on a Saturday night. They had a huge room upstairs, about 400 people, and then downstairs they sat about 250. You would just go up and down the stairs to work. And one of the stories I tell in the book was I got out in the car, I was doing some cocaine for the ride home, and some cop raps on the window and pulls me out and cuffs me, and they're putting me in a cruiser, and a policeman off duty who was working security at the club looks at me and goes, oh, what are you doing with him? He goes, oh, I was doing cocaine. And the off duty cop goes, oh, let him go. He's one of the comedians, as if that's a get out of jail
free
card. Wow. So anyway, it turned out it was.
Wow.
They took me out, uncuffed me, and the cop looked at me and said, you have no idea how lucky you are. The DA is up for re-election. And they love nothing more than parading white suburban boys in front of the camera right before the election.
Mm.
So anyway, that was like one of the, and then I was driving the wrong way on the interstate one night so drunk, you know. And,
that's scary.
And then I went after my 6-month-old son one night. He was crying and I spanked him. And Tammy took him away from me and sat on the end of the bed and fed him. And that was it for me. That was the most humiliating thing I could think of ever doing.
Yeah.
I mean, so anyway, I told her, you don't take me to this meeting tomorrow. I'm not going to go. And if I don't go, I don't think we're going to make it. So she took me to AA, and that started the whole thing, man. It was just this thing about 7 or 8 years of just constantly going, you know, what's the point? You know, they'd say higher power. And I go, look, if I'm making up a deity, that makes me delusional. I mean, it's a nice fuzzy thing, you know, like a bumper sticker, you
sure.
know, until life happens. You get death of a child, the loss of a job, cancer or something, and you're on your knees trying to find some comfort, and your brain's chirping at you. Who are you talking to?
Right.
You
know, yeah.
It's not real. So anyway, that was, yeah. you know, that was it.
I think it's like portrayed a lot of times, you know, the story of a dark, dark place and a turnaround even through God is a story that people have gone through. Obviously, this is a big part of the church and why people go to it. But like it's often presented as this like moment, right, where you go from dark to light.
Yeah, now I'm fixed.
Yeah,
and
now
that's
I'm
not
fixed.
Even close.
It's not. This took a lot of work after.
And
you
I'm
had
still.
This
moment. I mean, believe me, the Bible's clear. Paul talks about it. We have old nature, and then you say to God, I want the Holy Spirit, whatever.
Yeah.
That's your new nature. So you got this thing warring. I mean, and believe me, I'm not holding myself up. I don't want the NSA going through my, stuff, man. You know,
yeah.
I'm telling you, I have a major work in progress.
Sure.
And I said, I have to be careful now because of all the exposure that I've been getting online and stuff. Now
right.
People are recognizing me. So
yeah.
I told my wife, now I can't even throw a fit at the airport because I'll go viral.
Right.
Christian comedian.
Yeah.
That's why it was funny. We mm-hmm. Every time we would watch Survivor, mm-hmm. Tammy says, oh, you'd be perfect. I can see it. You know, 2 days without food, your blood sugar drops, and now you're choking other and right below it, it says, Christian comedian.
Yeah, you know? Jeff Allen. Yeah, it's funny because that journey for a lot of people, like, has so many ups and downs. It's not even a smooth,
not at all.
You know, and I think, like, I mean, I think about this in politics. I know how closely you follow politics too. And you know, the country is not like this straight line story of freedom, right? Like the world as it is errs towards the side of despotism and authoritarianism.
Absolutely.
Right? Just like we naturally sort of err toward the side of being terrible human beings.
Right.
And if you're not constantly trying to bring yourself back to the Bible or from a political sense, the Constitution, you can get lost really quickly.
Well, I have five questions I put in the book that I visit at least monthly in my life.
Really?
As an assessment. Uh-huh. What defines me? Most men will give you a vocation. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then you're basically a victim to your circumstances. You lose your job, you lose your vocation, you lose your meaning and your point and compass to life. So what defines me is, Sartre, before he died, came to a conclusion. He said that his philosophy was unlivable, existentialism. Mm-hmm. He said, in order for something finite to have meaning, it has to be attached to something infinite and fixed. Now, he would never say God. He was an atheist, but mm-hmm. that sounds like God. So anyway.
Sure does.
So what defines me? What do I value? I used to look around and wish I had stuff, things, material, and I want to be a man of integrity. I really do. I want to integrate what I believe with how I live. Mm-hmm. And that's the struggle, because there's without a standard, then you are an existentialist. You're just, you know, following your passions.
Right.
And that got me to the gutter. What are my expectations? You know, I tell my wife all the time, if you would lower your expectations of me, I would meet them and you'd be a lot happier.
Right. This is your fault.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
But expectations, very important. What voices do you listen to? You know this.
Yeah.
It's a very noisy culture.
Mm-hmm.
So what you choose to put in your mind and your heart, it will come out at some point. So pay attention to the voices you listen to. I still, to this day, we have friends that watch CNN and MSNBC. And I sat down with them, tried to have a serious conversation with them. I said, 2 years they perpetuated a lie about Trump. Hmm. 2 years, night after night. This doesn't bother you? This doesn't force you to at least
re-examine your viewing choices?
The credibility of the information you're getting, you know? So anyway, what voices do you listen to, and then where does your hope lie? If your hope is in the next election, I feel sorry for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I really do.
No kidding.
And again, I wrapped up in the 90s. I talked to Glenn about this. I said, I was never more miserable in my life. You know, and I was working with a guy. I tell this story in the book. I'm working with a guy in an AA thing, and he says, I said, I'm so miserable, man. This sobriety thing. And he goes, how much news do you watch? And this was before Fox. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, not much, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. I was just out in the hotel room. It was CNN headline news.
Yeah.
And he said, he was in South America. The Pope was there. And he's backslidden Catholic. He says, well, who doesn't want to see the Pope? So anyway, he goes out,
sure.
250,000 people. One time the Pope says, let's get on our knees and pray. He said, most profound experience I've ever had, certainly in a religious sense. Mm. He said something washed over that entire place. So I go back to my room that night, and CNN covered the 15 protesters that were calling the Pope the Antichrist. And he said, I realized the camera is just that big. It's myopic. And mm-hmm. whatever that news director chooses, and you got a paradigm that's 24/7. If it bleeds, it leads. So what can go wrong with pumping that into your soul 7 nights a week, you know?
Yeah.
So it takes some time. You know, I try to tell my grandchildren, I go, you live in the greatest time in the world. I mean, the internet, you can bring in lectures from some of the greatest minds that God has ever produced, or you can just sit and play, you know, Animal Farm or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Know? No, it's true.
I mean, you have the choice to sit down and edify and fill your soul with something that may benefit yourself and mankind, consequently mankind, you hope.
I see it with Glenn. I mean, Glenn, you know, obviously he's been sober for a long time, but like he has those battles with the news where he gets so into those worlds of right. It's just darkness, right? And he struggles, I think, to stay on top of it.
When we had dinner one night, I said to him, I go, what was it like at Fox when you kick over a rock?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know? That's what it seemed to me.
Yeah.
As a viewer, I had just heard of him, and yeah. I'm watching this, and like every night we would sit down, and it was like, holy cow.
Yeah.
You know, I did, and then it leads here, and it's like, it's been going on, all these tentacles. And you can get in it. I got into it with apologetics for my faith. I wanted to learn sure. how to defend my faith. Mm-hmm. And a pastor saw me reading, I think it was a Ravi Zacharias book. And he said, you like that? I go, I feel the need in the world I'm in, the secular world. Mm-hmm. You know, you should have an answer.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, be careful. I went down that rabbit hole for 19 years. And he said, there's always questions. He said, in the end, it's really a leap of faith. I mean, you, at some point, you're going to have to just accept the fact that you don't know everything. Mm. And it was about 3 years after that it hit me. I mean, I was on my 37th book, and I'm going, it's just getting circular.
Yeah.
It's just this constant thing back, you know, so...
So you're a quick learner. It only took you 3 years after that moment to pick it up.
To pick up the fact that yeah. I'm never going to know.
Right.
I said to a friend of mine that's an atheist, I said, why don't you shoot for agnosticism? You know you don't know. How
right.
about that?
Yeah, there you go. We could agree. Yeah, like, just go there.
Yeah, you don't know.
Well, look, your journey's really been one I know has inspired a lot of people. And you know, the book is there for people who are maybe going through this or just want to be entertained. Because, of course,
yeah,
it's funny.
Yeah, and I believe that I wrote it for 30-somethings, millennials. I'm working right now with a pastor here to bring Ecclesiastes to my Facebook page because I think it's so relevant. You get to be 30 to 40 years old, you got the wife, you got the house, you got the car, you got all this. And that was what I went through because, you know, people go, why are you so miserable? I go, I don't know. I checked the boxes. I had a beautiful wife. I had healthy children, job I loved, you know, and, you know, we were struggling financially, but that was because I was spending more than I was bringing in to try to salve this wounds. So anyway, there's an answer to all of this, but it takes thought, it takes an effort. Socrates said, an unexamined life is not worth living, you know? And I almost called it an examined life because that was a period of my life that was, I was just constantly. So the negative side of that is that you're never available for your family because you're constantly in your head.
In your own head, yeah.
You know, and she's shaking me, you know, we're losing the house, you don't care. I go, I don't. She goes, who says that? I go, someone who doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know, I want to care.
Yeah.
I just didn't know why it mattered.
It's an incredible journey. Are We There Yet? My Journey from Messed Up to Meaningful Life. It's from Jeff Allen. Available now wherever you get your books. Make sure to pick up a copy today. Jeff, thanks so much. Great to see you, man.
Thanks, man.
With elections going on and coming up here in the next few months, it's going to get crazier than ever, especially when it comes to freedom of speech. You know how hypocritical the left is when it comes to that. To them, it's okay to chant, you know, from the river to the sea, but, you know, you calling the border crisis an invasion is some crime. We already know what big tech is doing, and they're going to suppress the truth. That's what they do. They even collude with our government to do so. Hunter Biden's laptop, we were just talking about that story. They're going to do everything they can to make sure that the right result comes out of these elections. Here at Blaze Media, we, you know, saw this coming. This is why we exist. Blaze TV and Blaze News is a place where you can speak freely with no repercussions. Blaze is a place where you can ensure that they can't cut us off from each other. So consider supporting Blaze Media where you can. We really do appreciate it when you do that. Not only will you get this show, you'll have access to everything else we do here from Blaze Original Series, Steve Baker's great reporting, so much more. Go to blazetv.com, subscribe today. When you do, use the code STU. Get $20 off your subscription. blazetv.com, the code is STU. Go there today and subscribe. Be part of the mission as we go into the 2024 election.